Okay, so welcome to the second session. We continue with our vision sessions, focusing this time on content from term two. Again, I will focus on things which are important. As you know, in term two, we spent a long time looking at the Enlightenment, and then towards the end, we moved to the 19th and early 20th century. Now, just warning for this year, you remember there was a strike, and we didn't have the session on Darwin and on Freud, unfortunately, two of my favorite ones. And so because of that, and that was already announced to you, we have added, originally the exam paper was written with these two questions, two sessions in mind. Now we changed it and added two extra questions to cover, two extra questions for, related to the content we talked about. And so, however, if you desperately want to answer these questions, of course you can. Yeah, but I mean, it is it's not forbidden to answer these questions on Darwin and Freud if that is your favorite thing and you studied everything and you read everything, and that's fine with me. Yeah, and if you want to discuss these things with me, please write me an email. Now, in our first lecture from this block, we began to introduce you to the Enlightenment, and it is central. Its central project, the science of man. And I would say slide, and you go on your PowerPoint as last week and you change the slide. So the first slide here. We started with a seemingly simple question: what is the Enlightenment? According to the Russian philosopher Immanuel Kant, and I'm not going to read the whole thing here because you know that very well, the Enlightenment is mankind's exit from self-incurred immaturity. Have the courage, he says, to use your own understanding. It is thus the motto of the Enlightenment. So here Kant argues that the Enlightenment involves humankind freeing itself from preconceived ideas. And he believes this process of mental liberation was actively at work in his own lifetime. Yeah, he thought it was actually going on when he was alive, this mental freeing job. So he's saying, if all men and women dare to know, dare to use their own judgment, their own thinking, they could all participate in developing moral ethics and laws that would create a happy society that would favor the many over the few. A system of equality and individual and collective freedom would emerge where the exercise of political and religious authority were consistent with reason, with thinking, with mental capacities you have. And we see the centrality of reason in a Cartesian sense here. Through your individual thinking, you will be able to control the world and yourself. Remember Descartes starting to think about these things. And by leading people to escape their basic physical and emotional drives, so the exercise of reason, enlightened philosophers like Kant thought to lead humanity towards the true nature, a nature that they deemed free from the desire to terrify or compel others. Yeah? So the idea is that you, through your own thinking, without related being to God or giving you ideas from other people, your own thinking, you're able to understand who you are, what the world is around you, and that will bring freedom to people. Those themes tie in directly with the Enlightenment's central project, the science of man. Next slide. The term was coined by the Scottish philosopher David Hume, you remember that, who thought to apply Newton's laws of nature to human nature. So Hume wanted to discover the laws of human nature via the empirical method and reason, and thus became the Newton of the moral sciences. Yeah, you remember that David Hume, was so inspired by ideas of Newton that he said, okay, let's do exactly the same for the investigation of man, of humans themselves. So Newton is about nature, but I will do the same Newton did for nature for human nature. So the science of man, which he coined the word, sought to uncover what human nature is. The project celebrated human reason above everything else, and nurtured the strong belief that reason and its application via the empirical method would enable people to get at what they really was. It sought to expand the understanding of all kinds of facets of human nature, including senses, ideas, imagination, passion, morality, justice, and man's relationship to society. All of that would be able to access through your own reasoning. And of course, once you achieved this, one could foster man's best traits, his or her individual traits, for the happiness of all. Yeah, you remember that the Enlightenment is a time in which, unlike today, I think Sophie probably told you that too, unlike today, the Enlightenment is not about like just individualism. Yeah, it's about human individuals thinking about their own condition, but the aim is always to create a happy society. So it's not like, you know, in a lens what we have today where everybody's grabbing everything can get for themselves, but it is the almost the opposite. It's the idea of free yourself, think for yourself, but the aim is to think for others who might not be able to think as you do. As you know, okay, how would such an inquiry proceed? Next slide. Of course, the first thing to note is science, we talked about this quite a lot, I'm sure, is not understood as natural science like today. When Enlightenment people talked about science, they understood this in a much broader sense, as a general inquiry following any inquiry following a rational method. So history writing is a science for them, as much as, you know, cooking could be a science, or pedagogy is a science. Yeah, it is all part of the science of man. So this big investigation, so science in a sense like almost like an investigation, a rational investigation into the question of what man is, and all the investigations in it, you know, all these different approaches you could take, anthropology, all these things are part of this big science of man. Of course, all undertaken by a rational reasoning, a reasoned mind, of course. Another very important point which we touched upon with Sophie was that while the science of man was pursued in a variety of ways across Europe, there were a shared set of assumptions underlying all of these investigations into human nature. And here's a reminder of what these assumptions were. You know, next slide. You have the slide which you know shows that there are four assumptions all Enlightenment discussions have in common. Yeah, number one was human nature follows laws. Second, human nature develops in stages, and this development is universal. You know, the stage theory of history, we talked about that. Third idea was human nature is perfectible. Yeah, human nature is something which you can better. Once you figure out what the rules and that of man is, you can of course then make man a better person. Human nature was no longer thought to be innately sinful, rather it could be trained to contribute to the common good and happiness of all. Yeah, so it's not about selfishness, it's not about one person, it's about one person thinking and then thinking for the goodness of all. So Enlightenment thinkers began their investigations into man's true nature with pre-existing assumptions about what human nature actually was. And from here, I mean, very similar, you remember from the first part of the course in which you have 16th century people or 15th century people doing exactly the same. They're not starting from zero, yeah? And the Enlightened people are the same. They have certain assumptions. There's something in this culture which makes people somehow think similar and have certain assumptions what human nature is. And from here, you know, from this introductory lecture into, you know, what is the Enlightenment and what is the idea of the Enlightenment of man, we then explored some of the ways in which these assumptions about human nature played out in practice. And so one of the sessions was about the noble savage. For example, we looked at perceptions of inhabitants encountered in the Pacific slide, an area where exploration focused in the 18th century. Yeah, different from the 16th century. I'm saying this because it's an interesting and important question to think about. What are the differences here about the 16th and 18th century? And in looking at these explorations, we revisited a theme already discussed in regard to the explorations of the 15th and 16th century. When we noted that Europeans were not objectively discovering people from the New World, you remember Columbus. Rather, they were incorporating this unknown other into their existing intellectual and moral framework. You just really think about, you know, Columbus, Vespucci, all those kind of people had, they were not, you know, they did not leave as blank canvases, but they had read a lot, they believed in things, you know, they had certain people they thought they could discover. So they're full of ideas what they will discover, and they had to, I mean, come to terms with a world which did not fit their expectations. In a similar process, I'm sure, for explorers in the Pacific in the 18th century. They do not encounter inhabitants here with a total blank canvas, like, you know, very much like the 16th century people. They arrive with all kinds of assumptions about what human nature is, and this fundamentally shapes their understanding of these new lands and new inhabitants. From here we focus a lot on how Europeans interpreted and understood Pacific Islanders. Once again, we noted, I mean, you noted, and because, you know, with Sophie, that their interpretations and understandings took place within a cultural, you know, particular cultural and ideological climate. With 18th century voyages, imperialistic and economic aims now fused with a new thirst for reasoned knowledge about the people and nature in these worlds. You remember that in 16th century, it's not quite that. You know, people are just basically, you know, discovering, you know, bananas or something. But it's not, somehow they're not going into the new world with the idea to learn something, to gain knowledge. They're just basically, for them, as you remember, for Columbus, the whole world was already existing. Yeah, it was nothing new to discover. But these people now, in the 18th century, move there because they want to discover something. So at this time, enlightened European culture was overwhelmingly concerned with discovering man's true nature, the science of man. And so people placed the newly discovered inhabitants in the Pacific within this framework slide. In particular, they began to relate inhabitants to theories about how mankind had developed in stages from savages to civil. So they saw these inhabitants as humans, but as humans on a lower level of the civilizing process. At the same time, the Pacific Islanders and their inhabitants became a projection space for European enlightened hopes, frustrations, and desires. In many, many travel accounts, for example, these islands are described as a kind of utopia, a society free from war and intrusive government and social inequality, which were all endemic across Europe in the 18th century. And in this context, huge discussions and debates ensued about what these Pacific Islanders were and on which stage of human civilization they stood. We found real ambiguity within these debates slide. For example, some thinkers started to discuss the worth and mixed benefits of civilization and whether alone, left alone, natural man would in fact be a kind of uncorrupted noble savage. And of course, in this context, we also get growing discussions about human differences and differences in mankind's history. So Pacific Islanders were clearly humans, 18th century people thought. But why were they so different in culture and appearance? How could one square this in relation to stage theory, you know, this idea of stages of civilization? As you know, Enlightenment attempts to classify the varieties of mankind were ultimately inconclusive. You know, they were really obsessed with classifying things. They put it in order in a new knowledge system. But they're really inconclusive. And they were certainly not conclusive enough to oppose or to justify slavery. And of course, in week two, we looked at women and slaves in order to investigate how 18th century contemporaries increasingly turned their obsession with difference and classification onto the physical body. And of course, we noted that the standard against which everything else was measured is the European wild male. Yeah. So in order to get to grips with the differences, with the obsession of figuring out why are people different, they start to look at the differences in bodily appearance. That's very new, really, in the 18th century. The next slide is a slide of slave slide. In terms of slavery, while we know there were criticisms of the practice in the 18th century, nothing actually changed substantially until the very end of the 19th century. So we have the continuing presence of slavery in the Enlightenment, and this presence presents us with a seeming paradox. This was the age when many thinkers like Rousseau, in his discourse on equality, for example, advocated equality, freedom, and restriction of arbitrary power. Yet at the same time, we have a system of labor in which human beings were treated as the property of their owners. And slavery was tolerated and recognized as a necessity for the plantation economies in the Caribbean, for example, in the English case. And I think this highlights that there was a big discrepancy between the rhetoric of the Enlightenment philosophers and what actually happened on the ground. So again, a very important question. Yeah. So in a sense, they preached one thing, but then if you look at the daily practice, you see things like, you know, slavery, and you start to think, well, ooh, how could this exist in a society which is so much about equality? In this context, a particular theme comes to the fore, which is a focus on the physical difference of African slaves. And we see men of science at the time working to progressively measure and classify these differences. I said, you know, they are obsessed with differences, 18th century people. And they want to kind of come to grips with it. So they measure things, they, you know, they compare it, they just find ways of painting and drawing these differences. And also increasingly, empiricism and its investigation of the physical nature of man became a forceful argument in the debate over slavery. By which I mean that people start to argue it because of the physical differences, they are inferior. For example, we looked at the ideas of people like Buffon, Charles Carl Linnaeus, the Swedish guy, and the German Blumenbach slide. Together with Linnaeus, Blumenbach was one of the first to explore the study of mankind as an aspect of natural history. Yeah, he puts man into a history of nature. Imagine this. It's a really big step comparing to people in the 16th century who could not even think that. You know, they thought it was, you know, humans were created by God. Everything else too, but humans were special. Well, now Blumenbach starts to say, well, no, perhaps humans are part of a general history of nature. Yeah, and he compared this. He looked at this in relation to race and argued the differences between the races and skeletal structure went well beyond what might plausibly be argued to be effect of climate and environment. So he comes up with this new theory. His work also gave legitimacy to the notion of natural hierarchy of races listed in order here in the next slide. And Blumenbach's work, which claimed that race was not just about climate, as earlier kind of writers have thought, but also structural and internal differences, made distinctions between races seem far less flexible and far more fixed. Moreover, by the end of the 18th century, assertions that black Africans formed a race whose characteristics uniquely fitted them for slavery and justified its imposition as natural had become a common part of pro-slavery positions. Yeah, so people are arguing because they have these bodily differences, they are different, and that is inferior. Yeah, I mean, that's the argument. Of course, during the period, we also see an increasing scientific attention paid to the autonomy of women, not just their sexual organs, but also their skeletons and cranial size and shape. And this evidence was used to prove that women were fundamentally different to men and therefore fitted to different social roles. We looked at related ideas presented by a number of Enlightenment thinkers, for example, in Rousseau's educational work Emile, slide where you see him and Emile. He presents clear understandings about the nature of women, how they are naturally different to men, and thus why they required a different education and should perform different social roles. In particular, he presented women as being naturally fitted to domestic duties, particularly providing warm maternal care to their children and loving companionships to their spouses. So he's painting a picture of the perfect mother, an ideal considered to be natural and therefore both right and inescapable. And this notion was propagated throughout the 18th century. We looked at similar concept forwarded by thinkers like Dr. John Gregory slide, who forwarded the idea that because of their physical nature, women were emotionally credulous and incapable of reasoning. Instead, women's nature intended them for domestic families. We also looked at individuals who took issue with these ideas, people like, you know, Mary Wollstonecraft slide, now today still celebrated as one of the first feminists, who declares in her famous work on the rights of women, I quote, "I may be accused of ignorance, still I must declare what I firmly believe, that all the writers who have written on the subject of female education and manners, from Rousseau to Dr. Gregory, have contributed to degrade one half of human species and render women pleasing at the expense of every solid virtue. And of course, the most prized virtue is the ability to reason. Now, a number of historians have reflected on why this is happening. Why are so many people, including women, embracing the idea Wollstonecraft is pushing against? And why there's such a focus on the distinction between the sexes in this period? Slide. Next one. And a central theme that historians like Thomas Lacour have noted is that during this period, we also see increasing scientific attention paid to the anatomy of women. Not just their sexual organs, but also their skeleton, craniums, and shapes. For example, they had smaller cranial cavities and therefore were naturally intellectually inferior to men, it was argued. And there was an increasing reliance on medical evidence to back up the idea of women's natural affinity with a domestic fear. And these are the ideas, so Lacour argues, which opened up new avenues through which to amplify messages about women's inferiority. So I think when we look at these two groups, women and slaves, we can see that the Enlightenment, for all its universalist claim and its search for universal human subject, equality, and so on, run by reason and rationality, had great difficulty to trying to find a place for particular social groups considered to be different from the standard of the white male. And what we see happening is an increasing attempt to present differences between genders and races as based on natural facts. So the argument is increasingly put that things are natural and behave naturally, that humans are part of a nature, you know, not necessarily related to God. So nature is gaining a marked degree of authority. Nature becomes good, morally different. Another thing, it is what we saw, is that nature or natural was emerging as a moral category in the Enlightenment. So what was natural was also usually good, you know, the good savage, you know, I mean, the idea that people at the beginning, I mean, in the Pacific were good because they were kind of, you know, less clever and less intelligent, but still kind of morally good. Or women are closer to nature, therefore good. And as we saw what became onto our week on Adam Smith, this concept spilled over into all kinds of spheres. For example, it shaped concept about commerce and economic man. In particular, we see the rise of the idea that markets, like human beings, should be able to act naturally. Now we move to Adam Smith. Now this is a very concept for us today, you know, that market should act naturally. Well, in Corona, we just started to see that clearly that's not the case, and that the idea that they act naturally is pretty much bullshit. But never mind. Today we talk about the free market, and it operates in the framework of neoliberalism. Now that's what the free market for us is talked about. Indeed, we noted that figures from the new right, such as Hayek, Friedrich Hayek, or new liberal right in the beginning of the 20th century, Friedrich Hayek, drew a direct line between Adam Smith's ideas and their own ideas about modern liberalism and the free market, what we now call neoliberal conservatism in economics, which of course celebrates the competitive individual and narrow self-interest above anything else. We saw that Adam Smith has often been conceived as the maker of the homo economicus. And as Hayek claimed in the quote here, Smith's Wealth of Nation marks perhaps more than any other single work the beginning of the development of modern liberalism. Now, through these extensive celebrations like this and the popularization of these works in the 1970s and 80s, Adam Smith came to be seen as the patron saint of unrestrained capitalism. So Smith became associated with ideas of competition, the inefficiency of markets, and the benefits of self-interest and also austerity. Now, our session on Smith really thought to challenge these interpretations by placing him firmly within his own historical context. We noted that the kind of behavioral traits referred to today in attribute to his work have virtually nothing to do with the model of human nature Smith was actually creating in his own writings. We look at the development of this thinking and some of the people who shaped his outlook, such as Francis Hutcheson and David Hume, and the precise historical environment in which these all took place post-Act of Union Scotland. And of course, we made the broader point that thinkers are firmly embedded within a particular social and cultural context in this context shape what they think and say about human nature. Again, we can see this, how even Adam Smith was an economist, and we now celebrate as, you know, the major economist, again, was very much stuck in his own time. A new slide. In the case of Adam Smith, he was first and foremost a moral philosopher who thought to construct a model of being a benevolent society that could function without the control of an overbearing monarch. In his very famous text, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which he wrote before The Wealth of Nations, and it is actually the book he is famous for in the 18th century, his central proposition was humans have a natural sympathy we feel for others, and this guides all forms of sociability, and of course, this benefits society. From here, Smith goes on to try and demonstrate a link between morality, sociability, and commerce in his second major work, The Wealth of Nations slide, in which he shows that commerce and economic process were ethical beneficial. From here, Smith goes on to work and want to try and demonstrate a link between morality, sociability, and commerce in his second major work. So he was not simply constructing a model of how a freely competitive market economy might work under ideal conditions. He was seeking to identify how humans can behave in a manner that was capable of producing public benefit under the right circumstances. So Smith is a moral philosopher who, in both works, offers an explanation of the kind of social relations he saw as appropriate for commercial society. And this is very much rested on the workings of sympathy and benevolence. You remember that. Indeed, when it came to discussion about society and how man operates within society, it's moral philosophers like Adam Smith who were leading the way in the 7th and 18th century. This includes conception of mind, so how individual man reasons and thinks. Next slide. As we saw, a particular important figure who kicks all this off in the 17th century is John Locke, whose sensationalist theory and idea of human understanding are engaged with by many philosophers in the 18th century, including people like Hume in Scotland and Condillac in France. Yeah, this is a subject I think you should all kind of revise. I mean, the question here, what different kinds of idea of mind and thinking emerges from the 17th century onwards? And this is a particular lecture. You just basically have a look at this more closely. So in the 17th and 18th century, philosophers like this really led the discussion about self, mind, and human behavior. And their theories informed various political and social reforms programs. But this was to change dramatically in the 19th century only. Yeah? But here, unfortunately, and the corona, which then hit, we are not going into this. Yeah, so I will not kind of talk about Darwin, I will not talk about Freud, and I leave you with this summary of what we did. Yeah, and it's just a reminder again, you can answer, you know, these two questions, one on Freud and one on Darwin, if you dare, if you really want to do it, if you think, you know, you read all about it and it's why you did the course for. Please do. I mean, I think daring something in an answer, one should always do what one is inspired about. And if that is what inspires you, you know, don't shy back, do it. Yeah. But, you know, it is on your own. You cannot then claim, you know, basically it hasn't been taught. That's the one thing you should keep in mind. Yeah. But otherwise, I'm very happy to read these things. And if you want to talk about this, Darwin and Freud, and you feel a bit unsure which direction to go, please give me an email. Yeah? Okay, that's it. I will put this on right now, and I will put on the PowerPoint. Bye-bye.